Speaker today is Abhay Ashtekar, who's going to speak about quantum evaporation of 2D black holes.
Okay, I'm trying to do this slightly differently by standing up here rather than sitting in front of the phone. So if at any time you don't hear me well, please intervene and tell me to get closer to the microphone, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. Topic is quantum evaporation of two-dimensional black holes. For the past couple of years, we have had some seminars in the International Quantum Gravity Series on this. And what I'm trying to do today is basically give an overview of everything that has happened in the last over the last 2 years, basically a summary of various developments. There are two main issues which are in the first black line, which the first is that there's a conceptually new angle to look at the black hole evaporation, which is possible for these two-dimensional black holes, which I'll explain. And the second is really high-precision numerical calculations, which were essential for this. So the talk has three parts: introduction, then the mean field approximation, which is both analytic but largely numerical results, which give us all kinds of new intuition, and then full quantum gravity. The analytical issues were investigated with Victor Tavares and Madhavan Varadarajan, and the numerical calculations were carried out mainly by Franz Pretorius and Fethi. There is a physical review letters which was sort of almost 2 years ago, and the two detailed papers which should appear hopefully this month. All right, next slide, introduction. So what I'm doing in this slide is basically summarizing the standard scenario that has been used ever since Hawking told us about black hole evaporation. So that is what I'm summarizing the first part of the slide. So the scenario basically assumes the following. We've got some black hole that is formed due to gravitational collapse, and then due to quantum effects, it evaporates. And therefore, we have a kind of a new space-time with a flux of quantum radiation. And the first assumption is that, as in the classical theory, the space-time that would emerge out of this quantum analysis is also asymptotically flat at future null infinity, scry plus, in quantum gravity. The second assumption is that because of quantum radiation, the body mass decreases and it reaches Planck size when the horizon area shrinks to Planck size. And the third assumption is that this whole process, until we reach this Planck size, so the black hole is macroscopic, so to say, is quasi-static. And because it is this long, there's a long quasi-static period here, and in this period, the external field approximation should hold, and therefore the radiation should be given by the thermal spectrum. That is to say, it is a mixed state. And then the conclusion in black is that correlations are continuously lost over this very long phase. At the end of this phase, the black hole has a Planck-sized mass, and now the full quantum gravity effects will be essential for the first time. But whatever the details of the predictions of this full quantum theory are, there is very little mass that is left over to compensate for the enormous loss of correlations which happened when the black hole shrunk from, for example, a solar mass size to a Planck size. And these cannot be restored because there's just too little mass left. And therefore, the conclusion is that the S matrix cannot be unitary. Pure states on scry minus evolve to mixed states on scry plus, and there is information loss. And this has been the puzzle. Now, in string theory, if one just assumes the ADS-CST correspondence, then by definition, quantum gravity is described by a gauge theory on the boundary, which is unitary, and therefore the S matrix is unitary. But the problem is basically that we do not get any understanding of space-time processes, how it is that this Hawking argument or the standard argument that one gives is really bypassed by the idea of safety correspondence. That is what is not clear in the string theory arguments. And so the question is, can we give a space-time description of what is going on? And the point here is, given in the blue at the bottom, that even though this the argument that I sketched just now sounds very solid, but ignores the possibility that, in fact, there can be small corrections which come from quantum gravity due to the external potential approximation that was used by Hawking. And these may be very small, but because the black hole evaporates on such a long time, these secular corrections might actually accumulate and therefore invalidate the Hawking scenario. And this was sort of something that was sort of suggested a while ago by Martin and me. And we will see that, in fact, the detailed calculations show that the assumptions 2 and 3 above are, in fact, violated. That is to say, the body mass does not really reach Planck size when the black hole shrinks to Planck size. And also 3, that the flux at infinity, at null infinity, is really thermal. So both those things are actually not borne out in the quantum evaporation of two-dimensional black holes. Next slide. So let me just summarize here what is new. I mean, the two-dimensional black holes, even the CGHS1, have been in the literature for a very, very long time, you know, almost 20 years now, 16 years or so. And so there have been many, many papers, and so what is new in what is happening up here? Why is it that we need to get such qualitatively new conclusions? Well, the first is a certain viewpoint, which is not a major point, but still it is important if one comes from string theory perspective. This, the CGHS black hole, the Callan-Giddings-Harvey-Strominger two-dimensional black hole, they were actually introduced historically by they were motivated by certain Dilutonic black holes, extremal Dilutonic black holes, or C equal to 1 non-critical string theory. Whereas we are not going to look at those motivations, we're just going to look at it as something quantum gravity. You know, just there's a classical gravity theory in which there is gravitational collapse, and then what happens to quantum radiation. The second point is that there's a new formulation, and this really is a key point, and I realize that in this transparency it will not be clear, but I'll come back to this again and again. The key point is that we obtain a certain mathematical formulation of the problem in which the mathematical state, both in the classical and the quantum theory, is defined on a fiducial geometry, and that is actually rather easy to compute, as you will see. So there are mathematical variables, and one can evolve what happens to these particular fields and their states, and that we can calculate very directly, very easily. All the non-triviality now lies in interpreting the state in the physical geometry of the theory. And this kind of upside-down version of the problem is what makes it tractable and tells us what the answer is. I don't mean to say that everything is clear, but the main points become clear, not the details of the process, but the main points become clear. Third point, we will use what we call mean field approximation. Basically, this is an approximation in which is often roughly is also semi-classical gravity, is the approximation in which we ignore the fluctuations of gravitational field, but we keep the fluctuations of matter fields. And this is something that one often does. This also is very closely related to the large N limit, large number of matter fields, so that the fluctuations of these matter fields are not ignored because the number is very large, but the fluctuations of gravity can be ignored compared to the fluctuations of the matter field. Now, the new thing really that has happened due to Pretorius and Fethi Ramazanoglu is that there are high-precision numerics. These really were absolutely required. Even in the older literature on CGHS black holes, numerical calculations were performed by, for example, Piran and Strominger, and before that by David Lowe. But those numerical calculations really dealt with black holes, which were tiny in the beginning, you know, whose mass in natural Planck units was about 1 to 2 Planck masses. And then if you start with such tiny black holes, you don't see the real process. You would like to begin with macroscopic black holes. And to incorporate this requires very high precision numerics, basically the rounding off error should be to 16th decimal figure, and the convergence is about h to the 7, where h is the lattice spacing. And this high precision was made available only over the last year. And then this mean field approximation is interesting in its own right, particularly because it suggests some nice problems for geometric analysis, mathematical relativity. And finally, in full quantum gravity, what one has, as I emphasized before, is a space-time picture of how information is recovered. And the intuition behind this picture, a lot of it comes from the singularity resolution in loop quantum gravity. And in fact, the CGHS black holes were looked at in loop quantum gravity by Alok a while ago. But in fact, the analysis is not tied down to loop quantum gravity. The reason why information is recovered or the S matrix is unitary is much more general. So the final status is that there is excellent analytical and numerical control on the mean field approximation or semi-classical gravity. And then when we use these mean field results together with three educated assumptions, which I will state, we can conclude that the S matrix is in fact unitary, and we can discuss the physics of the outgoing state. Next slide, please. Okay, so let me begin with some details about CGHS black holes. Now, some in the audience might have seen these black holes in great detail, and in some sense, the detailed transparencies are for them. But at the end of each part, I will summarize what one really needs to know. And these are not the details, but general conceptual ideas. So first point, let's forget about two dimensions for a minute, and let's just consider a spherical symmetric collapse of a scalar field F in four-dimensional general relativity. Now we can write the four-dimensional metric as a two-dimensional metric, GAB, which is a metric on the RT plane, plus R squared times a unit two-sphere metric, SAB. Now, instead of writing R, I can write the magnitude of R as e to the minus 2 phi, because R is positive in classical theory. But since e to the minus 2 phi would be dimensionless, I need a constant of dimension of length. And I introduce a constant kappa, which has dimensions of 1 upon length. And I write R squared as e to the minus 2 phi upon kappa squared. So our basic geometry is now captured in the two-dimensional metric GAB and a dilaton field phi, and also there is a new constant kappa of dimensions inverse left. In terms of these, the standard Einstein-Hilbert scalar field action is written down on the next line. So it depends on the two-dimensional metric, the dilaton field, and a matter field F up here. And there is actually the scalar curvature term. There is the gravitational part has not only the two-dimensional scalar curvature, but also has some factors involving the dilaton, because R trickles down. And similarly, the matter field action is not just grad AF, grad AF, where grad is a two-dimensional grad compatible with the metric in the RT plane, but rather there is also a dilaton factor, e to the minus 5. Now, this is what would happen in general relativity. The model that CGHS considered is somewhat different. In their model, the fields are the same. There's a two-dimensional metric, a dilaton field, and a scalar field F. And the action is written on the next line. And I don't want to go through every step, but you can see that there is a close parallel between what happens if you did a spherical symmetric reduction, which is in the black, of four-dimensional general relativity with a scalar field, and if you looked at the CGHS action. We get essentially the same terms, but the coefficients, which are in red, are different. And this is why one expects the CGHS black hole would give us good intuition about what happens in four dimensions. But there is a key simplification. The key simplification is that in the CGHS case, the battlefield action is just given by grad AF, grad AF. There is no dilaton field there at all. The dilaton and the matter field are decoupled, and therefore I can solve for the matter field equations of motion independently of the dilaton. And that is what technically happens, and that is why it is technically much simpler. So F in CGHS is a scalar field, and the physical metric is GAB, but we're in two dimensions, and we're considering topology, which are just R2. Therefore, the two-dimensional metric is conformally flat. Therefore, I can introduce a flat Minkowskian metric, eta AB, and write the physical metric GAB as omega times eta AB. So the gravitational sector now, which involves, so to say, R, which is captured in this case in the dilaton field phi, and the metric, which is now captured in the conformal factor. So the four-dimensional and two-dimensional actions are rather similar, but as I said, CGHS is technically much simpler because the matter field F now satisfies the wave equation with respect to G, but because it is conformally flat, it is also just wave equation with respect to a fiducial metric eta AB. And then if you give me any solution, F, to this equation, it turns out, it's not trivial, but it turns out that we can write down the solution for the gravitational sector, phi and omega, in a closed algebraic form. And to write down explicitly, what I've done here is written down the Minkowskian metric GAB in terms of the advanced and retarded coordinates G plus and G minus. And I've introduced Kruskal-like coordinates given by exponential of these G coordinates. Then, instead of talking about little phi, what is going to appear everywhere is going to be exponential of this little phi. Therefore, I introduce a new variable called capital phi, which is e to the minus 2 phi. And finally, just to simplify our equations, instead of talking about omega, I introduce a field theta and write omega as theta to the minus 1 times phi. So our new fields are going to be the scalar field F, the capital phi, which is the dilaton, and theta, which captures the conformal factor. So the geometrical fields are theta and phi, and the matter field is F. Now the matter field satisfies the wave equation on Minkowski space, so its solution is trivial to write down. It is just given by F plus of Z plus F minus of Z minus. And then we also have theta, and then the solution for theta, it turns out, is just given by minus kappa squared X plus X minus. And solution for phi can be written down algebraically. And it is here that matter couples to geometry. And it is given by a double integral of derivative of this scalar field F that is given down. So the important thing here is just to note that, in fact, one can write down the answer in a closed form. So to summarize, what I've seen in this transparency is just that there is a close similarity between spherical symmetric reduction of four-dimensional gravity and the CGHS model. And second, that there is a small difference, but it is important technically because it enables us to solve fully analytically the equations of the CGHS model, and I have written down the solutions for you. Next transparency. So now we talk about gravitational collapse. So on the left-hand figure, I just shown you Minkowski space, M0 eta, and Rose diagram, and a scalar field F plus, which is just moving left moving mode up here. It depends only on Z plus. Of course, a boring scalar field, nothing happens up here in Minkowski space. And it determines, as we saw in the last transparency, the solution completely. It determines phi, it determines theta, and it determines metric, because metric in GAB is given by phi as theta minus 1 times eta AB. Now these fields, you can go back to the last transparency and convince yourself that these fields are in fact regular everywhere on the Minkowski space. So the question is, well, wait a minute, it's such a boring theory you're telling me. I mean, how can there be a black hole in this theory? Everything is completely regular. Well, what happens is that the field phi, for any given profile F plus, the field phi, the solution I wrote down, vanishes on a space-like line, which is a wiggly line on the right-hand side diagram. And since phi vanishes, that means that the conformal factor vanishes, which means that the contravariant metric vanishes, which means the covariant metric blows up. And you can calculate the curvature and check that the curvature of this metric actually blows up on that space-like line. So the physical space-time, mg, is smaller than the Minkowski space-time. And it is given by just the part of Minkowski space-time, which is to the past of the wiggly line, the part of Minkowski space-time, which is shaded. But it is important to note that the right part of scribe plus, right, is actually complete with respect to the affine parameter y minus of the metric G. See, the Minkowski metric, its affine parameter of these null lines is just given by Z minus. But we have got a new metric, which is the physical metric G, And we have to calculate what the affine parameter is with respect to this metric. And even though at the singularity, Z minus is finite, the value of Y minus is actually infinite. So this scribe plus write is actually complete. And now what we can do is we can look at its past and ask if its past is all of space-time. And its past is not all of space-time. There is a region there, which is the triangular region just beneath the singularity, that signals from that region can never reach the physical space-time, and therefore we have got black hole. Let me summarize. For the CGHS black hole, the mathematics is completely trivial. Theta and phi can be solved entirely. The non-triviality is interpreting this mathematical state. So the mathematical state is just given by solution f, theta, and phi. And the non-triviality is, how do we interpret this state? And the interpretation has to be done with respect to the physical metric g, and then we see that there is a black hole. Next transparency. So you might say, well, we just got lucky. Wait a minute. I mean, you know, you just got this black hole. This, by the way, is very nice to do in a class in general relativity, because people can see a black hole forming in front of their eyes. We don't need any numerics or anything for that. But one might say, well, this is all just classical. Dynology cannot be all that good once you bring in quantum effects. But this is not correct. Dynology is good also for quantum effects. So the next question we want to ask is, okay, you formed a black hole. Can I talk about Hawking radiation? Now remember, in the Hawking effect, what one had was a collapsing black hole, and then one looked at a test field propagating on that black hole background. In our case, the black hole is formed by the collapse of a left moving Mohr H+. Therefore, it is natural to introduce a test field, a field whose effect on the geometries can be ignored, but which feels the curvature. So we're going to introduce a test field, and our test field is going to be F minus. In other words, the right moving Mohr. So I look at the test quantum field F hat minus, which depends only on Z minus, on this dynamical black hole space-time. Now, classically, F minus was zero on the left scribe. Therefore, it is natural to assume that for the quantum field, what we have is a vacuum state on left scribe. And now the key question is, if you have this vacuum state on left scribe, what is the outgoing state on right scribe plus? Remember, these Mohrs, F plus and F minus, just travel one way, right? Because F plus just depends on Z plus, and F minus just depends on Z minus. So F minus just travels right, F plus just travels left. There is no backscattering in this model. So that's the question we want to ask. Now, in the blue, what I'm noting is that F hat minus dynamics is actually completely trivial in the fiducial Minkowski space, because it solves the wave equation on the Minkowski space, and I know what happens. If you give me in Minkowski space the vacuum on left scribe minus, then this is just a vacuum state throughout space-time, and therefore on scribe of Minkowski space, I'm just going to get a vacuum state again. But the key question again is, what is the interpretation of this vacuum with respect to the physical metric G? You see, again, mathematically, the state is obtained in a very trivial manner. There's nothing very profound about it. So all the physics lies in the interpretation of this state in the physical metric G. So this is the formulation that I was talking about in the beginning, which is looking at the problem from a new angle. Okay, so let us look at this state in G. So on the right scribe plus of Minkowski space, I got a vacuum state. But the right scribe plus of physical space-time is only a part, the dark part, of the right scribe plus of Minkowski space. The dotted region is not present there. Which means that I'm going to have to trace over those modes of Minkowski modes which live in the dotted part. And this is the point two in my black. Namely, I have to trace over modes on the part of scribe of Minkowski space-time, which is not shared by the physical space-time. And there is a second part, which I denoted by one, namely, to interpret the state, we had to use the positive and negative frequency decomposition with respect to Y, not with respect to Z. The vacuum state was defined with respect to Z, and now I have to define it in Minkowski space, and now I have to interpret it with respect to positive and negative frequency decomposition of the physical metric G. So these two things just say that I got a different positive and negative frequency notion, and I have to trace to the future modes. When you take this into account, you find that on the scry, or the physical space-time, the state is in fact a mixed state. Furthermore, it is actually a thermal state, and the thermal state is a temperature, kappa times h bar, exactly as in four dimensions, kappa is the surface gravity, and therefore there is information loss. One difference from four dimensions, which is going to be important later, is that this kappa is just a constant. It does not depend on the mass of the space-time. In four dimensions, black hole, as it shrinks, it gets hotter because surface gravity depends on mass. In two dimensions, surface gravity is just a constant, and therefore, in this Hawking effect, the temperature just remains constant. I mean, it's just the same thing. Okay, so in the external field approximation, there is indeed the information loss. But the quest, the hope is that if you take into account back reaction, then this loss could be avoided. Next transparency. So the back reaction is taken into account in the mean field approximation. Now, in the last part of the talk, we'll see that there is a framework for full quantum theory. But the mean field approximation is basically obtained by taking this quantum equation and ignoring the quantum fluctuations of geometry, that is to say, of the quantum fields theta hat and phi hat, but not of the matter field f hat. And as I said, this requires a large number of matter fields n. And therefore, what we obtain at the end is just partial differential equations for the field phi, which is the expectation value of phi hat, and for the field theta hat, which is the expectation value of theta. But now these equations include back reaction. So we got two sets of equations, as in classical relativity, the hyperbolic evolution equations in blue, and there are constraint equations in black. D plus D minus refer to derivatives with respect to Z plus Z minus. So D plus D minus is just a wave operator. And what we can see is that the right-hand side of the evolution equations have h-bar in them. So that right-hand side is actually zero in the classical theory. And that is why the equations are simple and we can solve them analytically. But quantum mechanically, we cannot do that. And this right-hand side being non-zero is what is called as conformal anomaly. And in these equations, n-bar is just n divided by 24. This is what appears in all the equations, n divided by 24. And then there are constraint equations, and these are preserved in time. So we can just impose them initially at scry minus, and then they will be preserved in time, and then we can forget about them. So we got these two sets of equations. The physical metric in the mean field approximation is again given by phi times theta minus 1 times the Minkowski metric. So what is our task? Well, our task is to solve this equation. Now, as I said, this is not possible analytically, so we are going to use numerics here. And there are global issues. Do these solutions GAB admit scry plus right? Is the bonding mass of scry plus right positive? What is the value at the end of the mean field evaporation? Is the bonding mass remain positive? Does it become negative? Is it large? Is it Planck scale? In a short, the initial scenario that I started out with, is that actually borne out in practice? So what are the answers? So the detailed analysis was done by numerics, as I said, and the answers are as follows. First, in green, I said that the numerics imply that indeed the metric G is asymptotically flat at right future null infinity, just as in classical theory, the space-time is asymptotically flat at future null infinity. Okay. So on the left-hand side diagram, I'm just showing the classical solution. And on the right-hand side diagram, I'm showing the solution which is obtained numerically for this semi-classical analysis. So what happens here is, again, I got scry minus and scry plus. In numerics, so far, the simulations have been done with a shock wave. So rather than having a profile, there's just a shock wave. And it's a shock wave that is used in all the particle physics literature as well. So I got this green shock wave, which is going on. It's called F wave. F is for the field F. I got this wave, the shock wave that is going up here. And what I find is the following, that at a certain point, there is this dotted line which is moving upward, starting from the green line, and that is a dynamical horizon. So basically, you've got marginally trapped surfaces which are formed, and what happens is that the area of these marginally trapped surfaces shrinks. In the mean field approximation, there is also singularity, which is denoted up here, but there are two differences from classical theory. This singularity is weak, the metric is actually invertible, and it is continuous across the singularity, but it is not C1. So it's a singularity, the scalar curvature blows up. But the singularity then meets the dynamical horizon at a given point and ends there. At that end point, the kind of, so to say, the singularity has been weakened so much that there is no mass or there is no curvature left in the singularity. And then finally, we got this last ray, which I have written down up here. So just as on the left-hand side diagram, the physical space-time of the classical physical metric is given by the shaded region to the path of the singularity. Now, the region is really bounded by the singularity in the last ray, and you look at the path of the singularity in the last ray, and that is the physical space-time of the mean field approximation. All right, so I'm now reading from the transparency in black. Space-like singularity does persist, but it is blue, but it is weak, and the metric G is invertible. It is continuous, but not C1 there. Also ends, the important thing, the singularity ends because of evaporation. It does not reach sky plus. And there's a last ray, which is the future boundary of the mean field space-time. And more importantly, these detailed numerical simulations show that the Ricci scalar is actually finite along this last ray. So the singularity does not propagate out to infinity. In the literature, there has been many claims of earlier. The general belief was that there was so-called thunderbolt singularity, and that the singularity would just go out to infinity, and that is why the mean field space-time is incomplete. But that's not the case. Geometry is perfectly fine along the last null ray, so you could actually extend the space-time to the future of the last ray, but you need some new input because equations themselves have broken down at the singularity. Okay. But the important thing here is the following. How big is sky? This is in blue. The numerics show that the affine parameter of the physical metric is finite at the last ray. You see on the left-hand side, we've got the event horizon, and the affine parameter of the physical metric at the event horizon, y minus, it actually became infinity. And that's why sky was complete. We had a notion of a black hole. But now, at the last ray, the affine parameter, y minus, of the physical metric is in fact finite. And this is what one would have hoped. Otherwise, there would be definitely information loss, as in the classical solution, as in the external field approximation. But the fact that sky plus, right, is incomplete means that you cannot really even ask if there is an event horizon. So in the semi-classical space-time, there is no event horizon. And what, not dots, but what forms and evaporates is the dynamical horizon, which is given here, showed here by a dotted line. That is what is really forming and evaporating. Next transparency. Now we can go back and ask answers to various questions that we posed. First is about body mass. The black hole shrinks down, as we saw in the last transparency, to zero area. The dynamical horizon area shrinks to zero when it meets the singularity. What happens to the body mass? Well, in the literature, there is a notion of body mass that has been introduced. Actually, it was introduced already by CGHS, but in more convenient forms by Suskin et al. And Hayward and so on. And numerically, this is plotted. So what we're plotting is area of the dynamical horizon versus the traditional body mass versus the area of the dynamical horizon. And what one finds is that, as one would expect, as the area shrinks, the mass, body mass shrinks. But at some stage, actually, it crosses zero and it becomes negative. And in this case, the ADM mass was from 360. And you can see that the dynamical horizon mass is becoming minus 52, minus 53 or something. So it's a large chunk of the ADM mass. So the dynamical horizon mass becomes negative and is large, and in fact larger the n, we're using large in approximation, larger the n, larger is the negative body mass at the end of this mean field evaporation. But it turns out that there is another notion of body mass, which was introduced by Badhavan, Varadarajan, Victor Tavares and me 2 years ago. And our notion, at that time, of course, we did not know this problem with the traditional body mass. But in retrospect, one can see that the fact that this body mass is negative, traditional one is negative, is not very surprising from the four-dimensional relativity perspective. The traditional definition of body mass is taken from the classical static solution. So the analogous thing in four dimension would be to use the body mass to be equal to just the integral of psi q naught on a cross section of scribe. This gives the correct answer in the stationary space-time. But in non-stationary space-time, dynamical situations, you have an additional term in red, sigma is a shear, sigma is sigma bar times sigma dot. And this term is essential in the dynamical situation. If you forget it, if you use a standard, I mean, if you use the same definition as in the static space-time, just psi two naught, then body mass and flux would not be positive also in four dimensions. So this suggests that, in fact, what was done before was that they just ignored the fact that one might have to modify the notion of the body mass as you go from static to dynamical situations. So this is what was done by us, and our answer is given in the next paragraph. Basically, following the standard bound procedure, we first looked at the behavior of the fields asymptotically, and the scalar field phi, the dilaton field phi, behaves like some function of z minus times exponential of z plus some function b of z minus plus terms which die off exponentially near scribe plus. And the detailed analysis shows that A determines the affine parameter y minus with respect to the physical metric g in the semi-classical gravity, and the coefficient B determines a certain balance equation, which is the Black equation, which is given below. And that equation says that the rate of change with respect to y, so d by d time, if you like, of the quantity in a square bracket is equal to the right-hand side. And as you can see, the right-hand side is manifestly negative. That means the quantity on the right-hand side is decreasing, and following intuition from four dimensions, we took the body mass to be the quantity in the square bracket on the right-hand side, and then we see immediately that the flux is necessarily always positive. Now, this definition does agree with that in the static case, because the difference between the two definitions is really the terms of the order of h bar. If you said h bar equal to zero, our analysis would just say that the body mass is constant, and this body mass, which is just the first two terms in the square bracket, or the green terms on the right-hand side of the equation, ATV definition, this is a traditional body mass, and we recover that in the static case. But the flux, is, as we see here, is manifestly negative, and also, when the flux vanishes, then we see that d by dy minus is equal to d by dz minus. That means the asymptotic translations with respect to the physical and the fiducial metric are the same. Now, why is this important? Because positive and negative frequency decomposition is defined with respect to asymptotic translations. So the statement is that when the body mass vanishes, positive and negative frequency decomposition with respect to the Minkowski metric and with respect to the metric, semi-classical metric, is the same. And finally, this was a big surprise for us, a pleasant surprise, is the statement in red, that numerics show that the body mass, the ATV body mass, is actually remains positive throughout the evolution. Next transparency. So this mass remains positive, and now what we want to do is to analyze the physics of what is happening up here. So actually, when we looked at the numerics, we realized we were at first very puzzled, because the new body mass remains positive, but at the end of the evaporation, even when the black hole area is actually zero, this body mass can be quite large. And we could understand how could it be so large. I mean, what's happening here? Why is the whole mass not getting evaporated? And what is couldn't understand the physics of this at all. I said, what was happening? And in fact, there was a question about the numerics were really good enough, so they were checked again and again and so on. And one kept finding this result. But then I realized that there is actually a scaling symmetry which sort of clarifies what is happening completely. Namely, if in fact F is a scalar field, N is the number of scalar fields, and theta and phi, if that is the solution of the mean field equation, then so is F lambda times N, lambda times theta, lambda times phi, for any real constant lambda. So these are actually the same. We've got a symmetry. We've got another solution for this mathematically. But physically, under this scaling, what we find is that the metric doesn't change. So under this scaling, in fact, the geometry does not change at all. And the ADM and the body mass are rescaled by lambda, just like N was rescaled by lambda. So what this suggests is that for geometry, for energetics, and for interpretation as scrapless, what matters is really not M and so on, but what matters is really M divided by N. And I've taken here N bar here just because N bar is the quantity that appears in the field equations everywhere. So what matters is really M star, which is really the ADM mass divided by N bar, and M star Bondi, which is the Bondi mass divided by N bar. And those other constants are just to make this quantity dimensionless. Now, what happens is that once you realize this, then we can look at what is the behavior, not of the body mass, but of this little M star B. And then one finds, rather surprisingly, that there is a universal behavior. The first point under universal behavior is, there is a universal behavior for global process. Namely, if you start out with a black hole, which is macroscopic in the beginning, whose ADM mass is very large compared to the body mass, or rather, capital M star is much bigger than 1, then what one finds is that for these macroscopic black hole, at the last ray, the body mass is actually universal. It doesn't matter what you start out with. You can start with the solar mass black hole, you can start with the galactic sized black hole, etc. But at the end of the evaporation, little m star b is just 0.86. So next transparency. So here is a plot of what is happening to the universality of mass. You see, what I'm plotting is m star, which is the final Bondi mass, against m star, which is the initial ADM mass, divided in both cases by n bar. And what we find up here is that, in fact, the curve is, most of the curve is just flat, and that is the 0.86 that we find up here. The curve does change, but it changes around the place where the ADM mass is about 4. So long as capital M star is larger than 4, there is a universal behavior. Okay. This is really ridiculously low, if like M star is. I mean, N can be large, so the ADM mass can be large. M is, the ADM mass will be equal to N times this ADM masses that I plotted, like 16, 15, etc., etc. So the ADM mass can be very large in the beginning, but the statement is that at the end, so long as capital M star is bigger than 4, there is a universal behavior. Then there is a change, and this I would call purely quantum mechanical black holes. And this plot gives us a scale as to which black holes are to be thought of as quantum mechanical or microscopic, and which are macroscopic. Macroscopic black holes are the ones for which M star is just bigger than 4. And what one finds is that the data, in fact, the entire data that I have shown here, can be fitted to a certain curve, which is written in red in the figure caption, little m star is equal to alpha times 1 minus e to the minus beta times capital M star raised to gamma. So I got this universal coefficients, alpha, beta, and gamma, and their values are written down up here. And I want to emphasize that this actually fits in the entire curve, I have not stopped at any point up here. But there is a sharp transition around m star is equal to 3, and m star is equal to 4, everything is fine. The transition point is about M star equal to 3. The old simulations that were done by Piran and Strominger, they corresponded to the lowest two points of this graph, where M star is equal to 1 and M star is equal to 1.25, so they could not see this universality. To summarize, what we have seen in the last two transparencies is the following. that the semi-classical equations, even though they seem just small corrections to the classical equations, have very enormously interesting properties, namely that there is a universality, namely the last area mass, the body mass at the last ray is universal, in the sense that it's not the body mass itself is universal, but rather body mass divided by this n bar. That is the quantity that we should consider for physical purposes because of the scaling behavior. Next, transparency. I have again written down here for you that the Penrose diagram of semi-classical gravity. Again, we've got the green line, that is a collapsing shell. We've got dotted orange line, that is a dynamical horizon, and the brown line, which is singularity, and the blue line, which is the last ray. And the physical space-time is to the past of the singularity and the last ray. That is the physical space-time for the mean field geometry. You can see that along the green line, there's a point at which the dynamical horizon first forms. The dynamical horizon isn't there all the time. It is first formed at some instant of Z minus, okay? Or, if you like, of Y minus. It forms at this instant of Y minus. What happens is that the quantum mechanical flux is almost zero to the past of this particular point before the horizon forms. And once the horizon forms, it rises extremely sharply and then stabilizes. So there is a transient phase up here. So just keep in mind that there is a transient phase. Next, transparency. Now what we want to discuss is universality of dynamics. So what I'm plotting here is on the y-axis is the area minus the body mass, and on the x-axis is the area itself. And what one finds is that there is a curve. And you can see that there is a curve which all other the various color codes denote the initial ADM M star. And what one finds up here is that the initial ADM M star can be large. For example, it is 14 for the blue part, it is 12 for the red part, it is 10 for the faint blue part, etc., etc. And just visually, it is clear that there is some curve that you can draw, and all other curves, all these curves are joining this universal curve. And this is exactly right. What happens is that, for example, if you look at the curve corresponding to 12, which is dark blue, there's the initial transient phase, that is when the dynamical horizon is just formed. The dynamical horizon is just formed for that case when the area is about 11. And then there's the initial transient phase between, say, area equal to 11 to area equal to 10. And after that, the evolution follows a certain universal curve. So basically, you give me a huge black hole, it is quantum mechanically evaporating. There is a transient phase just around the time the dynamical horizon first forms. And then after that, however, the evolution is all universal in time. If you like, the area of the black hole horizon gives us a gauge invariant notion of time. And as you move left along the x-axis, the time is increasing, and the body mass minus the area minus the body mass is following this universal curve. Next, transparency. The same is true with the flux that ATV gave. The ATV body flux is also universal. Again, you see here the following. There are several things to notice. One is that, again, the color coding denotes various values of the ADM mass. And what we can show is that, what we can see is that so long as the ADM mass is larger than 4, then in fact, we have a universal behavior. There is always a transient part of each of these curves, which is really the beginning of the curve as you come from the left, as you come from earlier and earlier times, when the dynamical horizon is first formed, where the flux actually the flux is given here. Remember, the ATV flux is negative, so everything is plotted in a negative way up here. Okay. So as you go down, the flux actually is increasing. So there's a flux which is increasing, and then it joins this universal curve. Now one might ask, okay, this is very nice, so I got universal behavior. How does this compare with what happens in the external potential approximation that Hawking taught us? In the external potential approximation, the flux is all thermal, right? And you can check that in two dimensions, thermal flux means thermal radiation means constant energy flux. And the value of that constant energy flux is just given by minus 0.5. So the external field approximation would say that the flux should be flat and should be given by minus 0.5. But remember, as you go down, the flux is increasing because the flux is, by definition, right-hand side of the balance equation is negative. And so, as we can see up here, is that the flux is increasing. And, in fact, there is a departure from the constant value of the Hawking flux almost throughout the radiation, throughout the quantum radiation. So there is a steady departure from the thermal flux, even as far as energetics is concerned. In other words, we're not shown you, I've not given you what the final state is, but I've shown you a contradiction. The contradiction is that if we assume that the flux was actually thermal and therefore correlations were lost throughout this long epoch, then I would have concluded that the flux is constant, and since in two dimensions the temperature is constant, the flux is also really constant, namely 0.5, and it's not 0.5, it's increasing as the black hole shrinks, and is significantly different from what is happening to the Hawking, compared to the Hawking radiation. So, summary, numeric next transparency, summary of universality. So there is a universal behavior with respect to global properties, namely that the last bonding mass is given by 0.86 Planck mass, and with respect to dynamics also. There are universal curves which actually are joined after the transient phase. And the most important thing is in the brown below, however, there is a small but cumulative difference between this MFA evolution, which includes the back reaction, and the external field approximation of Hawking effect, which does not. And this implies that even the flux of energy is not thermal, and this is important for recovery of information. Okay, so I talked about mean field, and now I have to go to the last part, which is shorter. Are there any questions about mean field?
Bye.
Yeah.
Maybe two questions. Maybe first is short. The second, maybe we can postpone to the So let me make both. This is Carlo. The first question is just technical. There are two metrics in your pictures, right? The Minkowski metric that uses fiducial one, and the physical metric, the G that you compute out of the matter fields, right? Do they have the same causal structure?
Yes. In two dimensions, they have the same causal structure.
Okay, so this is why you can do a common panels, because there's a sort of universal causal structure here. That's what was good. The second question
that would be also true if you did the spherical symmetric reduction coming from four dimensions, because this is a property of just two dimensions and trivial topology.
Okay, so and the second question is there seems to be a sort of tension between these two. The universality you talk about, it's obtained by scaling by the number of fields, right? On the other hand, the Hawking radiation, the way it was originally considered, it does not depend on the number of fields. Do you have clarity about that? Is there a tension or not?
No. Hawking radiation also depends on the number of fields. It's just that in Hawking's calculation, he just considered one field. If he had considered n fields, then the flux would be n times what you obtain. The energy.
Well, the temperature does not, but the total flux would depend on the number of fields.
Exactly.
So these two things together?
Yes, everything fits together. So the reason why in Hawking's original calculation, one could just deal with a single field is because one was not looking after back reaction. If you want to take into account back reaction, at the moment, the only detailed control approximation we have is the semi-classical gravity, which is large in approximation. And that is where the number of fields is important. In other words, if I want to take into account back reaction, and if I just set in my semi-classical or mean field equation n equal to 1, the domain of validity of those equations would be very, very small. As I increase n, the domain of validity in space-time of those equations increases. So Hawking did not have to worry about this because we were just not looking quantitatively. In the issue of back reaction.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Yes, this is Albert Rohrer from the Albert Einstein Institute. So I have a question about what one would expect in the four-dimensional case, in the sense that, so here in the external field approximation, for the two-dimensional case, the flux is the thermal flux is constant, whereas in the four-dimensional case, when the black hole is very large and you have a very, start with a very large black hole, you have this very long period of time in which it is evaporating, where the flux is very, very suppressed by the inverse square power of the mass of the black hole. That feature is quite different from the four-dimensional in the four-dimensional case as compared to the two-dimensional case. So, do you expect that that would make a significant difference as compared to, as far as expectations are concerned, to the two-dimensional case that you were describing?
So, first of all, here it is also true that just for everybody else, it is also true that until the dynamical horizon is formed, the flux is almost negligible, and that feature is shared also with four dimensions. But the point you are making is that once the dynamical horizon forms, still to the future, the flux is very, very small in the four-dimensional case because the temperature goes like one upon the mass of the four-dimensional black hole. And the flux, in fact, increases as time goes on, because the temperature of the black hole increases. And this is absolutely right. And of course, because of this, there will be technical differences. But qualitatively, the statement is that there are two independent effects. Two-dimensional model, for that reason, is really neat in the sense that it enables us to disentangle these two effects. In four dimensions, the flux will increase both because of just the temperature of the black hole is going up. But the two-dimensional calculation suggests that it will also increase because there are the secular changes which are happening as the black hole evaporates, which are not taken into account in the external field approximation of Hawking. So these secular changes are very important, and that is what is missing. In other words, in four dimensions, to the standard scenario, we would have to add an additional growth, which depends on the number of fields, et cetera, and there may also be universality and so on and so forth. So there will be superimposition of this two-dimensional effect, of this effect we first discovered in two dimensions, on the standard scenario also in four dimensions. Is that okay? Okay.
Maybe. Thank you.
Okay, you can ask me again at the end if you like. Okay, let me continue now. So the next transparency, next slide, which has to do with full quantum gravity framework. Now we want to go beyond mean field approximation and want to see what happens in full quantum gravity. So now we have to have operator equations. And not too surprisingly, the operator equations are very similar. It's just that instead of classical fields, we've got this operator compared to what we have seen in the semi-classical approximation. So it should be possible to solve these equations, at least perturbatively, in the dimensionless Planck number, GH bar. This is a great simplification in two dimensions. Namely, two-dimensional Newton constant has dimensions of one upon action, and therefore GH bar is dimensionless. Again, in this quantum equation, the true degree of freedom is in F hat, in the matter field. And so phi hat and theta hat will be defined on the Fock space of F hat. The initial state we want to give is a vacuum state for the left moving modes. It is a vacuum state for the right moving modes, but this state is given on left scry minus. And it is going to be a coherent state for the right moving modes which collapse. So the situation is really similar to what happens in the classical theory. It's just that we're replacing the classical matter shell or the matter profile collapsing by a coherent state which is peaked at that classical profile in blue. So we know that in the fiducial geometry of eta, the state, past vacuum or state on left scry, evolves to the future vacuum state on right scry. You see, because the evolution of this, the field F hat, does not depend on theta and phi at all, as we see in the hyperbolic equations, in the blue equations called hyperbolic equations. F hat just satisfies the wave equation in Minkowski space-time. So the situation is the same, namely dynamics of F hat is trivialized mathematically, and all the meat is put in interpreting the state that we get. So if you look at what is, if you start out with a vacuum state for F hat minus, for the right moving modes, on left scry minus, and we want to know what is the state on the future scry, that state is still going to be the vacuum state with respect to Minkowski space metric on right scry plus. And the question in red is, what is the interpretation of this mathematical state in the physical geometry G hat constructed from this theta hat and phi hat? That is the question we have to address. Okay, next transparency. So we don't, unlike mean field approximation, we cannot just put these equations on a computer and solve it. At least I do not know how to do it. So we make three assumptions. The first assumption is that the mathematical solutions, F hat, phi hat, and theta hat, are well defined on the entire Minkowski manifold M0. Now, this is an assumption. I cannot defend it very strongly, but there is supporting evidence. We have done several approximations. This is we, meaning Madhavan, Victor, and I have done analytical approximations. Amos Ori also has done some quantum calculations, which are also approximate quantum calculations, to show that, in fact, the weak singularity in the mean field theory would be resolved in quantum gravity, and therefore the equations, the quantum equations, would be well-defined. But at this stage, it is an assumption. The second and third assumptions are common. Second assumption is that the mean field theory holds in a neighborhood of right scry minus. This is a standard assumption. If this, you don't assume this, then you cannot even ask about if the information is lost, if the S matrix is unitary, et cetera, et cetera. And this seems reasonable because we are in the weak field region up here. And the third assumption is that after the last ray, you see, at the last ray, we have a remaining body mass, which is about 0.86 per scalar field. And the idea is that this remainder body mass will be emitted after the last ray. And this is a pure quantum gravity process. Semi-classical gravity cannot predict it because if I look at the causal path of what happens after the last ray, it involves the singularity. So the assumption is that that after the last ray, the remainder body mass will be emitted to sky plus, and after the body so this mass is all emitted, and after that, the boundary flux should vanish. In other words, we should not get continuously boundary flux at infinity, making the body mass negative indefinitely. So the assumption is that the remainder mass will be all emitted at sky plus, and after that, the boundary flux would actually zero. So these are the three assumptions. Okay, the first assumption is that the quantum fields are well-defined on the manifold M0. The second assumption is that the mean field approximation holds near scry plus. And the third assumption is that the body mass which is left at the last ray will be radiated away, and after that, the flux would be zero. With these assumptions, we can show analytically certain things. Namely, we can answer the key questions. The key question here is the sky plus right of the mean field geometry of the expectation value of G hat, if you like, is that equal to the full sky plus of Minkowski metric, or is it a proper subset of this Minkowski metric? Well, if it is a proper subset, if in fact the sky plus of the quantum geometry is actually smaller than that of the Minkowski metric, then we would have to trace over the future modes. And since we have to trace over these modes, the pure state, even though we've got a vacuum state with respect to eta, that would appear as a mixed state with respect to the physical metric. And S matrix will fail to be unitary. And the second key question is the following. Even if, supposing it turns out that sky plus of the physical metric G hat is as big as sky plus of the Minkowski metric, what is the affine parameter? What is the relation between the affine parameters, Y minus and Z minus? You see, there are two effects that we saw that lead to Hawking effect. Namely, one is that one had to obtain the Hawking effect in external field approximation, we had to trace over the modes, those modes which were in Minkowski space but not in physical space. So if I had to trace over, this is the first part of this key question, then we are stuck. Then there's going to be S-matrix and is going to be mixed. S-matrix will not be unitary, the state will be mixed. And we are in the external field approximation, we also had to take into account the fact that the positive and negative frequency decomposition with respect to physical metric and Minkowski metric were different. So we had to calculate the Bogoliubov transformation. And the statement is that this is what one has to do here. Now, namely, what is the relation between this affine parameter? If these affine parameters agree as one approaches I-naught and I-plus, if the Z-plus and Y-minus approach each other sufficiently fast as you approach spatial infinity and future time-like infinity, then positive frequency, positive and negative frequency decomposition with respect to the affine parameter of G and with respect to the affine parameter of eta will be unitarily equivalent and the S-matrix will be unitary. Otherwise, the S-matrix will just not be defined because basically the outstate would not lie in the Fock space of the physical Fock space at scribe plus. Next transparency. The result is that the information is lost, not lost, because the detailed analysis shows that our assumptions imply two things. One is, indeed, the scribe of the physical metric is as long as scribe of Minkowski metric. Now, I don't want to say this is completely trivial, but this is something that one can follow from the bonded loss mass formula, etc., that I discussed before. And the second is that Y minus is related to Z minus in such a way that the Bogoliubov transform is well defined. That is to say, the vacuum state at scribe plus right with respect to eta, that is the state that we mathematically we know that's the state we have. That state does belong to the Fock space as scribe plus right of the physical geometry G. I should add that this kind of mathematical completeness and sophistication was not really done before in the literature. So the space-time description is the following. The scenario here, because we do not have a full theory because we have not solved the quantum Einstein's equation. But the picture that one has is really that the singularity is replaced by quantum region, which is kind of this shaded region in the middle of the diagram. That is the region that we got, where quantum geometry is fine, but the mean field approximation or the large end approximation fails because of very large quantum fluctuations. And as I said, there is supporting evidence for this coming from this mini superspace analysis of Ori, in which he actually evolves quantum state under some approximations across this classical singularity. Then we have carried out a truncated theory which shows that, again, that the field should be perfectly fine. And, of course, there is a black hole resolution of a black hole singularity in a four-dimensional loop quantum gravity, etc. But this is still something that is not established. This is the paradigm that is being proposed, that this is what is happening in the space-time description. Next, transparency. So I want to summarize now. Classical and semi-classical theory. That is, this transparency is a summary of the classical and semi-classical theory. In the classical theory, the mathematical state, S, phi, and theta, if you give me these three values of these three fields, then that determines the mathematical state of the theory completely. This mathematical state is regular everywhere on the Minkowski manifold M0. But the black hole really arises when we interpret this state in terms of the physical metric G. So this is a viewpoint, I mean, it's obviously true, but this is a viewpoint that we want to really hammer on, we want to adopt in everywhere. Second point in green, Hawking effect in the dynamical black hole space-time. Again, in this case, we start with the test field F hat minus, and in this, again, it's on the left-hand diagram, on the left scribe minus, we start with the test field, which is the vacuum state, and we evolve it. And mathematically, the evolution is trivial. It is just equal to vacuum state on entire left scribe plus of Minkowski space. Right scribe plus of Minkowski space. But the point is that because we have to trace over some modes, and because there is a mixture of positive and negative frequency, this state is interpreted as a thermal state with temperature kappa h bar on the right scribe plus. The right-hand side diagram talks about back reaction. So when the back reaction is included in the mean field approximation or the large end approximation, now the singularity persists but is weak. The traditional body mass becomes negative and increases with n. If you like, this is just a red herring in the logical story, but I had to say it because people will otherwise ask, you know, what is happening to what people were doing before. So we can, I mean, logically, we can forget about it and we can just focus on the ATV body mass. That remains positive. But what is, but it's, but the ATV mass itself is rather large at the end of evaporation. It is roughly given by 0.86 times number of species, and N is quite large. And high precision numeric shows that there is an unanticipated universality for a large number of physical quantities. I didn't show you all the physical quantities for which there is universality. I just chose the ones which are most important for this talk. For all initially macroscopic black holes, at the end of the mean field approximation space-time, little m star, the body mass at the end per unit scalar field, if you like, remains to be evaporated per scalar field. You said this is exactly what one might have expected, you see, because it was rather silly in retrospect to think that the total body mass would be macroscopic, would be about 0.86 or would be about one Planck mass, because we've got n channels in which it can evaporate. So what it is saying is that we've got this n, large n number of n channels through which the body mass can evaporate or the quantum radiation can take away the mass. And per channel, what is left is just 0.86. So if you like, I mean, it's not that the whole intuition was completely wrong, but it was imprecise. And then you put the precision back, but this precision is important because it caused a lot of confusion. Because if n is large, it means that even in the regime where the geometry is pretty classical, because n is large means the body mass is large, the area of the horizon is large, the geometry is pretty classical. But even in this regime, the standard expectations that people had made about quasi-static approximation are incorrect. Okay, next transparency. The summary of quantum theory. In full quantum theory, we made three assumptions. One was motivated by mini superspace calculations, truncation approximations, etc. And the two others are the standard assumptions that everybody else makes. And then with these assumptions, we are led to this ATV scenario for full quantum gravity. Namely, the state on Sky Plus is pure and belongs to the asymptotic Hilbert space of the physical metric G bar. So the S matrix is unitary and there is no information loss. So one might ask, people like to ask, okay, S matrix is unitary, but that's not the full story. When does the information come out? This is because this is a question that is often asked in particle physics literature. I just want to say some brief things about it. If in discussion there are questions, I will answer more details. Well, first of all, it's not completely clear that this question is well-defined. But to the extent that it is well-defined, most of it comes out before the last ray. Basically, very little energy is carried away by each scalar field after the end of the semi-classical space-time. Possibly because the state is not really thermal. This is possible because the state is not really thermal during the evaporation. Even the energy flux is different from what the thermal radiation would be over a long period. In green, while great many conceptual similarities with four-dimensional picture, there are also some important differences. And one of them was already pointed out, and I'm just going to emphasize a couple others. The first is what was pointed out. In two dimensions, the Hawking temperature does not depend on the mass. And this is a big difference. But let me again emphasize something, maybe say in different words, my answer to the last question. What we are saying here is really focusing on the difference between what external potential approximation will tell us and what the mean field theory tells us, taking into account back reaction, what it tells us. And it is true that they already in the external potential approximation, there is a difference between four dimensions and two dimensions because the mass is different, because the temperature in four dimensions depends on mass and in two dimensions it does not. But what I'm saying is that what is important here is the difference between the semi-classical picture and this picture. And so this difference will persist. So it is true that for a long period, there is very little Hawking radiation. And it's true that that would be also true in semi-classical approximation. But even during this period, the statement is that the expectation would be that the radiation would not be exactly thermal. There will be very small deviation from thermality, but this deviation would persist for a very long time. And of course, when n times the mass, when black hole acquires a mass which is comparable to n, number of species times the Planck mass, then the difference would become very, very important. Point two, in the two-dimensional CGHS black hole, dynamics of F and geometry are decoupled. This was absolutely key for us to be able to solve the whole problem mathematically to say what the state is at scrapless right, both classically and both in external field approximation for the Hawking effect and in full quantum gravity. This is not does not happen in four dimensions. So in four dimensions, all these things will have to be the results will not be so clean and simple. There will be approximations involved. And the third part, which is very important, and in fact, actually, namely, scry in this case, in two dimensions, scry has these disconnected pieces. Right scry does not talk to left scry. In four dimensions, so to say, you've got scry, which is S2 cross R, it goes round, and therefore there's only one scry minus and only one scry plus. You don't have disconnected pieces. And that makes a huge difference. For example, in our case, the picture that you see on the right-hand side up here, we've got this this collapsing shell, which is going out, this collapsing shell, and it's just moving towards left scry. And Hawking radiation is moving out to right scry. In four dimensions, there's only one future scry. So everything is going to happen on just this future scry. Now in two dimensions, for the shell crossing, somewhat surprisingly, there's very little information in the shell. There's a mass of the shell and there's a time at which it collapses. But still, I was rather pleased or surprised that this information is recovered at right scry plus through Hawking radiation or through the quantum radiation. The quantum radiation knows about this information, even though the shell, so to say, doesn't register on right scry plus. But I don't know if this is going to be true more generally if you just give you general profiles. My expectation would be that the answer is no, but I don't have an argument one way or the other. Okay, last transparency. So summary in a nutshell, the old paradigm for black hole evaporation for CGHS black hole is shown on the left-hand side, and the new paradigm is shown on the right-hand side. Basically, on the left-hand side, what happens is the following. You give yourself some state on left scry minus, and this state, say the vacuum state, and this state evolves, but part of this state would fall into the singularity because the future boundary of the space-time has the singularity as well as scry. So part of the state falls in the singularity, part of it goes to scry, and therefore the S matrix is not unitary. If you just look at the S matrix from scry minus to scry plus, it is not unitary, part of the state is lost. On the right-hand side, what we have seen is that, in fact, the state, which is the vacuum state in Minkowski space, we know as a fact that it is, in fact, the vacuum state with respect to Minkowski space on the right scry. The only question is, what is the interpretation of this in the physical geometry? And under the three assumptions, which are motivated by the semi-classical picture and by other calculations people have done, under those assumptions, we see that the right scry of the physical space-time is indeed as big as the right scry of Minkowski space-time. There is no tracing involved, and therefore the pure state actually goes to pure state. And furthermore, the detailed calculations show that this pure state is in the Fock space of the physical space-time, and therefore, in other words, it's not as finite, and therefore the S matrix is really unitary, it really is well-defined. Thank you.
Questions?
Carlo again. So let me take the arrival point of yours and suppose these assumptions are correct. So let me take the scenario that comes out. So if I get correctly, the picture, what you're saying is that if I look at the black hole while it is evaporating and it is shrinking slowly, I can just see what has fallen into the black hole, right? So I get out the information of what has fallen inside. That's true, right? So in a sense, the idea that the information is lost falling inside is wrong, because the details of the Hawking radiation that comes out carry this information. Can this be interpreted as physically as a sort of quantum violation of the no-hair theorem? As I see the black hole and the radiation that comes out, I can actually see different things from different black holes depending on what has fallen in initially. So the very idea that I can describe a black hole as just a single state has to be given up.
Yeah, so I think it is indeed the case that it is a violation of no-hair theorem, but it's not surprising for many reasons. So there are many levels at which it is not at all surprising. So I'll start at the grossest level and go to finer levels. So the grossest level is that the black hole uniqueness theorem anyway was for stationary black holes. And I know that in the kind of consciousness of people, sort of there was a metamorphosis, and people thought that this was true for dynamical black holes, et cetera, et cetera. I think the statement is that it is the case that, for example, if you look at the center of a galaxy, as Carlo and I were in this meeting in Spain just recently, and we had this astrophysical talk. So if you look at our center of a galaxy, and then there is this black hole, there is very little matter around it. It can be thought of as vacuum, it can be thought of as an equilibrium because not changing. And therefore, if I wanted to know what the metric around it was, I can make some approximation, draw some scry, say it's asymptotically flat, and in some approximation, that would be just Schwarzschild, and therefore there is no loss of, therefore the no-hair theorem holds. But this holds because we're not looking in fine enough detail. If one actually had been, in principle, looked even classically, right, and saw that there was this matter falling in, then one would say that, in fact, it's not true that it's given by Schwarzschild black hole, as Carlo, you asked the question. So even classically, if I just look fine enough, then the no-hair theorem would be actually violated. So the question is really about, when you come to quantum mechanics, there is a second point. The second point is timescale. So if you are willing to wait for eternity, then the no-hair theorem is definitely violated. In fact, there's no reason for the no-hair theorem to be true, because the whole thing is dynamical, it's not static, it's not vacuum. Matter, and even if you start with black hole is formed by collapse, it is not vacuum, etc. But you really, because of quantum evaporation process is very long, so for this information to come out takes very, very long time. And the final thing is really that the no-hair theorem and everything came because we assumed something about stationary black holes, asymptotic flatness, and this was all tied with the notion of an event horizon. And in fact, in this quantum black holes, even already at the semi-classical level, we saw that the notion of event horizon doesn't make any sense. Only the dynamical horizon makes sense. So a lot of paradigm on which no-hair theorem is based is just completely brutally violated in the quantum analysis. But this doesn't mean that the theorem is not useful. I want to emphasize again. For some astrophysical observations, if you are only interested in certain kind of accuracy, then the theorem is still useful.
More questions?
This is the Albert Einstein Institute again. If I can follow up a little bit on the question about the four-dimensional case. So let me, of course, the two-dimensional case is simpler, and there's the fact that you could do these very precise and nice calculations, certainly for the mean field approximation. But then for the four-dimensional case, let me first perhaps try to describe what I think is the common expectation or understanding for the mean field approximation in that case, as far as from the point of view of a number of people, although there are not detailed calculations in this case, of course, which is that in this case it is expected that when you start with a very, very large black hole, very massive as compared to the Planck mass, then for a long period of time when the black hole is evaporating very slowly, until it reaches, you know, until the mass, which is decreasing very slowly, and well before it reaches the Planck mass, you can use an adiabatic approximation because it's evaporating very slowly, so you can just use adiabatic approximation so that you can approximate geometry by almost quasi-stationary approximation. You take into account, in principle, the back reaction on the space-time, and what you expect, and you can even do some kind of analytical studies, is that when you take into account the back reaction on the space-time, what you will have is that the black hole space-time, the horizon will be shrinking, and that what you expect to get is that the temperature of the Hawking radiation will not be exactly thermal, but what you expect to get is some approximately thermal radiation whose temperature is changing slowly in time according to this essentially evolving according to the inverse of the m squared, where this m is following this formula that would correspond to the change of the mass according to that formula by Hawking. And and in principle, if you don't have a breakdown, if you trust in the context of this field approximation, then you would have this quasi-thermal state where the temperature would be evolving in time. But then the Hawking radiation would be, you would still have these entangled pairs. So as far as the correlation of and the entanglement of those pairs is concerned, you would still have these non-trivial correlations that you would be generating. And if this mean field approximation is valid until you reach, a sufficiently late time, perhaps the quantum gravity effects become really important, then the whole point is whether most of the correlations are recovered at or come out at late times, or whether, as you seem to find in this two-dimensional case, you sort of have departure from the usual expectation from this picture at much earlier time. So, in a sense, it seems that in this, even in the mean field approximation that you were describing, you were in the two-dimensional case, you were finding a departure from this picture, even in the mean field approximation. So,
yes,
the question is that
I expect that in four dimensions, if one does careful calculations and really keep a large number of fields, which is essential for mean field approximation, that you will find a departure from the Hawking formula. And it's not, I mean, with even Hawking formula that you're talking about, which is really time-dependent temperature. So I'm saying that, yes, there will be departure even in four dimensions. That's what I'm saying.
And so do you have some expectation? So you think that this quasi-diabatic approximation fails? So do you have some intuition on what part of
the... Yeah, it fails in the sense that I was saying before, namely, there's a competition between two factors. One is the corrections are very small, but these corrections accumulate over time. And therefore, you have to worry about accumulation. If you just give me a little slab of time interval, then, if I just looked at the energy flux and not looked at the state, because to look at the state, I cannot look at a state in a little interval of time. I need to look at it, on a scribe. So if I just look at the energy flux, then it's true that the deviation from the Hawking, from the thermal radiation, will be very small. But this deviation is going to last for a very, very long time, as you yourself said, that this phase is very long. And so there's a competition between two factors, which I don't think has been taken into account sufficiently carefully, because one usual argument is, this is what I had in my first transparency, which says introduction. The usual argument is precisely what you said, which is what I had also said before. But that just says that this is quasi-static, and therefore the thing is thermal, and then the correlations are lost. I'm saying that it was never quasi-static. To a sufficient accuracy, it was never quasi-static. It is quasi-static, but there are small corrections, but you have to add them up on a very long interval of time.
So I completely agree with what you're saying, but my understanding is that within this kind of, or at least some of these analysis of the back reaction within the mean field approximation to black hole evaporation, in principle that is they try to take that into account in the sense that you have these small effects, but they take into account the fact that you have secular effects that build up in time. So you have these very small effects, but it's important to take into account the secular effect because otherwise you would not get, for instance, the black hole evaporation, that you have these very, very small effects, but the build-up in time of all those effects, for instance, gives you the decrease of the huge mass of the black hole. But I guess that what you're saying is that nevertheless, probably you feel that there might be some small contributions that you think that are not being taken into account there.
Looking at the energy plus is a very poor, but in this case turned out to be enough, probe into the nature of the quantum state. I mean, there are many states, as you know, in Gaussian quantum field theory, which are completely pure states, but which for a very long time, that energy flux would approximate that of a thermal state at a given temperature, even though the state is completely pure. So, in this CGHS model, one was lucky, if you like, and it was very brutal, namely, that even as far as the energy flux is concerned, there was a departure. I mean, one might not be so lucky always, namely, that as far as the energy flux is concerned, there would be a departure, there would be a cumulative effect, but this effect itself may not be enough to argue that the state is pure. But what I'm trying to say is that this is not a necessary condition. This is just a sufficient condition to say that the state is pure. And the final thing that I want to say is that you're right. I mean, you know, there's no hard calculation that we have in four dimensions. But if we look at the rich literature on CGHS, exactly the arguments you made have been made, and in particular the role of this N was really not taken into account. What matters is not Planck mass, but N times Planck mass. So there are three scales, Planck mass, N times Planck mass, number of species times Planck mass, and the initial ADM mass. And I agree that the initial ADM mass can be very large compared to N times Planck mass. But N times Planck mass is important because if N is large, then, you know, I can still have a nice geometry and I can still see some deviations from the external field approximation that one finds. So to summarize, the calculations that have been done in four dimensions typically look at stress energy tensor, and they are, well, one cannot conclude anything about thermality or non-thermality of the actual state just looking at the stress energy tensor calculations. I think that, I mean, one can argue only one way. If in fact the energy flux is not compatible with thermal flux, then there's a problem. Then it's not, the state cannot be thermal. But if the energy flux is very, very close to thermal flux for a very long time, I still cannot conclude anything definitely.
That I agree. So I guess that perhaps what I expect is that maybe in the four-dimensional case, it might end up being a bit closer to that, not as dramatic as what you found in the two-dimensional case.
Right, right. I think I agree with you. The four-dimensional case is not going to be as dramatic. That's why I like this two-dimensional case, where kind of, you know, some dramatic effects show up, and they are going to be subdued in the four-dimensional case. But then we know where to look for, what to look for, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that is the value of this calculation. We're just lucky that things are separated out so nicely, so we can look for these new features, which show up here like spikes, but will be, you know, not so dominant in four-dimensional case. But it's a guideline to look to what one should look for.
Thank you.
More questions? So I have a question, actually. In page 17, the one that says full quantum gravity, there is something slightly peculiar about how one quantizes these models, in that one doesn't just take the classical equations and put hats on top of things, but actually one takes the classical equations supplemented by these right-hand sides, which are anomalous terms proportional to h-bar, and then puts hats on top of that. Is that sort of inescapable, or one thinks that in the future with more work one could do a sort of more traditional from the grounds up, from scratch quantization?
No, I think that's something like this is essential, and something like this is kind of missing in our usual understanding of in other problems in quantum gravity, where one just takes the classical equation and puts hats on. In other words, I think that any time there are anomalies in quantum theory,
quantization procedure is something that we have to think more carefully about than what we have done, than what is often done. So I do think that there is something about this that this model is teaching us. I mean, we spend a lot of time, Madhavan and I spend a lot of time in doing exactly what you said, namely taking their classical analysis first and putting this hat. And one just gets completely wrong physics. And so there is something new, I think, that in the quantization procedure itself we have to learn about, I think. So it's not so much that we learn to do this in a better way so that we can just take the classical equation and put hats on them. No, I don't think so. I think that this will tell us about where we have to be careful in quote-unquote quantization procedure.
More questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.